Hello, fellow foodies, and welcome to episode number 26. Now, I know that last time I promised you an episode on pumpkins, and while I do intend to get to pumpkins, I have to take a slight detour. You see, because in my most recent trip to the UK, I came across some really cool, exciting stories that I thought would be really fun to share with you. So first up, I'm going to open with an interview with Kim Walker and Mark Nesbitt. They are the authors of a brand new book called Just the Tonic. And this book gives an enlightening perspective on the history of where cinchona bark, which is the bitter ingredient that goes into your current day tonic water, how it came to be, and all those other elements to tonic water, how those came to be, including the carbonation of the beverage. So let's begin with a description of the book before we dive into the interview. And here it is. Did you know that tonic water was originally consumed as a digestive? And that quinine, the bitter-tasting alkaloid that flavors tonic water, was first mixed with brandy, rum, or wine, rather than gin, as the common belief states. Just the Tonic reveals the colorful history and truth behind the myths of this everyday drink. Now, Kim and Mark are really the perfect pair to write this amazing book, and this is because they both work at the Royal Botanical Gardens at Kew, where they both study artifacts that are present in the vast Economic Botany Collection. Dr. Mark Nesbitt is curator of the Economic Botany Collection at Kew. His research centers on botany and empire in the 19th century and on the history and current day relevance of botanical collections. He is also the co-author of Curating Biocultural Collections and The Botanical Treasury. Kim Walker is trained as a medical herbalist, and she now specializes in the history of plant medicines. Kim is working on a PhD on cinchona at Kew Gardens and University of London. She is on the committee of the Herbal History Research Network, the British Society for the History of Pharmacy, and is a member of the Association of Foragers. She is also the co-author of The Handmade Apothecary and The Herbal Remedy Handbook. I had a fantastic time chatting with Kim and Mark when I was recently at Kew Gardens, and I was so excited to have this opportunity to follow up with them on their release of their new book. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion as much as I did. Okay, well, hi, Mark and Kim. It's been great to see you. Actually, I saw you twice this month and Mark last month. It was fun visiting Kew and seeing the amazing collection of cinchona and thousands of other specimens in the Historic Economic Botany Collection. And I was thrilled to get a copy of your brand new book, which is titled Just the Tonic. So let's chat about that. Why don't we start with an introduction? You want to tell us a little bit about yourselves?
So I'm Kim Walker. I'm a PhD student at Kew here in the Economic Botany Collection. And I'm looking at Kew's collection of cinchona bark, of which it has the largest collection in the world.
And I'm Mark Nesbitt. I'm curator of the Economic Botany Collection. And I'm interested in how humans relate and use plants, in particular through time.
That's great.
And most importantly, he's my supervisor.
Fantastic.
And wonderful co-author.
Yes. Well, this book was just beautifully put together, not only from the stance of the story and the information, but I really loved all of the illustrations and images that you included. You mentioned, Kim, that the Economic Botany Collection at Kew has the largest collection of cinchona. Why don't we start there? Kind of give us some background on how this project came into being.
Sure, and thank you, for complimenting the book. It was a lot of fun to write and do, especially the picture research. So, Kew does have a really large collection of cinchona bark, really closely followed by collections in Leiden as well. But the importance of Kew's collection is they're predominantly South American barks, because cinchona comes from the eastern Andes in South America, that it's endemic to. And the collections mainly represent all these wild harvested barks. Now, what was happening in the 17th to 19th century was there were people harvesting bark in the wild and sending over bark packages to Europe for people to use it as treatment for malaria. And there was a particular gentleman called John Elliot Howard who was collecting this bark and analysing it, first to understand its botany, but also to understand its chemistry, first to help physicians and chemists and doctors understand these barks that were coming in from South America, see if they're good quality, are they even real barks, and second to help see which plants might have the most quinine so that they could grow it for themselves.
The collection really is massive, not only from the barks, but also the herbarium specimens. Mark, can you tell us a little bit more, as curator of the Economic Botany Collection, how this collection is tied to the herbarium?
Well, I think, yes, one of the strengths of the Economic Botany Collection is, you know, the huge volume of archives that sit behind it, but also the cross connections to the herbarium. And there are, in fact, about 1,000 herbarium specimens, about the same number as barks here at Kew. And Kim did a great crowdsourcing exercise, a little bit of citizen science, digitizing the specimens, putting them out on the web, and asking collaborators, members of the public around the world to help transcribe the label records. So from that piece of work, we sort of understand the distribution of the herbarium specimens much better. So we know that there's a really interesting set of 18th century or early 19th century herbarium specimens that represent those first encounters by Western botanists with the actual trees in the eastern slopes of the Andes, obviously a really hard area to get to. And then you've got herbarium specimens from the Indian plantations of the mid to late 19th century, representing that transfer of cinchona trees by Kew into the Indian subcontinent.
Wow. And for our listeners, can you guys comment a little bit on how is cinchona or cinchona integrated into tonic water? Let's just start with the bark, because as I discovered in reading your book, there are a lot of different elements that went into making the actual tonic water, including, you know, adding the gassy bubbles to the water, which I hadn't thought about historically was actually required quite a bit of innovation. So let's just start with this bitter bark. How did they historically integrate this bark into beverages? Was it always served with gin? Was it infused in water, or did it go into other types of beverages initially?
Okay, so it's a really good question, because when this plant was first being imported to Europe from the 1600s, it was as for its use as an antimalarial. Now, this is in early days of medicine. So when you get your bark, your medicinal bark, what you'd need to do is make it palatable. It's very bitter. So it would be ground down into a powder and then often decocted, which is like a long water simmer, or added to alcohol, particularly brandy or wine. And the alcohol in this case wasn't really for making tonic water or tonic drinks for pleasure, but just to make the bark palatable and help dissolve it so that it'd be more available in the body. This is a little bit later, different from the later story, which is when the active alkaloid constituent of the cinchona bark, which is quinine, was isolated after 1820. People were then not taking the bark. They were taking this white crystal powder in doses for malaria. Then how this gets put into tonic water is that back in Britain, somebody invents tonic water with the idea that the quinine's very bitter, so they add it to fizzy water to make a digestive drink. And actually, the very first tonic waters weren't for malaria, but were just for their bitter flavor to help digestion.
And how big of a problem was malaria historically in Europe? I think when we think of malaria today, we often think of the tropics, and you don't necessarily think of malaria as being a European issue or even a problem in the U.S. But was this a pretty serious disease in Europe?
Yeah, there's a new book out on the intertwined histories of malaria and quinine, malarial subjects, by Rohan Devroy. And he makes, I think, a really interesting point that in the mid-19th century, you get a shift where malaria is seen as this kind of colonial tropical disease. But just at the point it starts to decline in Europe, Well, it was very widespread, particularly in saline stagnant marshes. So, a lot of people are familiar with the marshes around Rome as being a really malarial area. And of course, that's where the term malaria, bad air, comes from, is Italy. But in here in England, it was prevalent in a sort of belt of eastern, low-lying eastern England, so along the River Thames and Kent and Essex, a little bit further north around the Wash. Really prevalent up until the First World War, when big-scale drainage works finally solved the problem once and for all.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and so you mentioned earlier the extraction of different types of cinchona from the Andes, and could you comment a bit on the number of species of cinchona that are known, and how is it that certain ones had higher levels of quinine than others?
So there's around about 25 species of cinchona, but new species are still being discovered. I think most recently in 2013, was it, Ken?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by an expedition led by some of our collaborators in Copenhagen. And it's always been recognized as a really tricky genus, because cinchona plants tend to look very similar. Trees, perhaps up to about 10 meters tall, beautiful panicles of lilac scent. Flowers, but they hybridize very easily. And some of the main characters separating the species are in fact leaf characters, quite subtle leaf characters. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until the late 19th century, mid-19th century, that botany was really sorted out. And that was important because there are differences in the distribution of alkaloid by species. And it was understanding that connection between the chemistry and the species that, in fact, enabled European powers to go in and appropriate the plant and transplant it successfully.
And so why were they transplanting it? Can you talk a little bit about this colonial, like, track of they go into a country and then these are being shipped out to other areas to grow? What's the history there? Why did they do that?
Well, I think there are interesting parallels to the medicinal plant industry today, in that there are several motivations, and one of those is economic. So in the late 19th century, British are spending a lot on importing quinine into countries like India, and importing it from Latin America. But there's also elements around quality and control, if you like. So the quinine that's being harvested, so the cinchona trees that are being harvested in the Andes, but are sometimes under control of state monopolies, sometimes under control of traders. And when these sacks of bark that come from the trees arrive in London, you don't know where they come from. You have to do quite a work to work out what the quinine content is, and it can be quite low. So I'm sure that a major motivation for acquiring the plant and developing plantations was not only that you can control the quantity, that if you want more and you want cheaper quinine, you simply grow more trees, but also you can do selection experiments, so you can select one of the most high-yielding trees.
That's great. And when I was there visiting the collection, one thing that you showed me that was just really fascinating was this one of the remaining Wardian cases that were invented by Nathaniel Ward. Can you describe that to us and kind of explain how these were used to ship plants and what were some of the risks of shipping plants back in those days?
The Wardian case was invented by Nathaniel Ward at Chelsea Physic Garden in the early 1830s. And before that, there are innumerable rather tragic tales of plant collectors coming back from 10 years' exploration, the ship coming into Liverpool with 20,000 dead plants, because the combination of tropical sun and salt water is a real killer for plants. So the Wardian case is a small glass house, about the size of a dog kennel, and you imagine the sleeping sides of this of sleeping style kennel being made out of glass. So you could sling a tarpaulin over it to keep the sun off. And that glass kept the fresh water in and the salt water out. And it really revolutionized plant transport right up to the 1960s when air freight took over. And really the Wardian case drove or enable the relatively easy transfer of, obviously, of cinchona tree, but rubber, coffee, tea, a whole range of perennial woody species, often with seeds that are quite short-lived, so simply sending packets of seeds wasn't a good substitute. Also, very widely used for transfer of ornamental plants too. So what you can see if you talk to garden historians or economic historians is a huge increase in the volume of plants being moved around the world in the 19th century with good and bad effects for human society.
Fascinating. One other element to the tonic, and I love, by the way, I love that the title is just the tonic, because there's so many books out there on gin and very few that I know of that really get into the history and the botany of the quinine in the tonic water. And as I mentioned, one of the things I hadn't really thought about is soda water and how we came to have soda water. Kim, can you tell us a bit about that process? And it's a relatively recent invention, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, so this was during the 1800s that people, well, let's start a bit earlier than that, because people have always had water as a kind of health-giving property. You can see that through health spas and baths that people have throughout history, from ancient Egyptians to more recently where I met you last week in Bath Spa,
yeah,
where people go and visit and take the waters. Now, scientists understood that these waters all kind of had special properties, because not only were they seemed to be healthy for people, but they also could be slightly preserved. And through a series of people investigating this, they worked out that it was carbon dioxide, or what they called fixed air. Somebody else did realize as well that fixed air, or this carbon dioxide, was one of the ingredients in water, also came off beer as it was being brewed. And this was noticed because if you looked over your vat of beer with a candle, it would extinguish, and sometimes people could pass out in the presence of beer brewing. Anyway, this range of different innovations around water and gas all led up to one particular person called Joseph Priestley, who was a dissenting minister and a really interesting polymath. I mean, we haven't got time to discuss him now, but he's very interesting to look at because he's involved with lots of discoveries, including the guy who discovered oxygen.
Wow.
But one of his interests was in this fixed air and brewery, and he noticed that from his visits to a local brewer that if he floated a saucer of water in the top of the vat of beer overnight, the next day when he came to pick it up, it was slightly fizzy. And basically he realized that he could dissolve this air into water if it's in high enough concentrates and make a little sparkling water. And that was basically the invention of aerated waters, or what later became known as soda waters, and was an important factor of the invention of tonic water, which later on includes soda water plus quinine.
Interesting. And there were all kinds of different tonics during this era, right? Can you tell us a bit more about what tonic was, these aperitifs that were being created? You also had cocoa wine and later Coca-Cola that came about here in Atlanta. But tell us a bit about that. You really do a great job of describing this in your early mixology chapter.
Thank you. So it's another thread about the history behind tonic water, which you can see has got lots of threads already. But another thread is, why was it called tonic water? During this period, tonics were a really important category of medicine that people understood to help you improve the health and vitality of the body. So you get lots of things that were ascribed as tonics, and I guess they were thought to like increase the resilience of the body against disease. And bitters were tonics, and therefore quinine was considered tonic, as well as soda water. So when you paired these both together, you got the kind of double, triple tonic water. And that's how the tonic water got its name, and the belief in tonics. Other type of tonics that were available at this time were, as you mentioned, coca tonic wine, which contained another type of alkaloid, cocaine, which certainly would have perked people up. Also things like coffee and chocolate, and more common things you'd find today that were originally as tonics were things like Coca-Cola and Dr. Pepper.
Oh, fascinating. And so when did we see this transition from including gin as, you know, the main part of the gin and tonic? Like, when did that marriage happen? And did the gin and tonic of this period, was that similar to what we actually drink today? Or were the levels of quinine much higher?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it's a little bit more complex to say this is the exact date, but the gin being paired with the tonic does certainly happen. Well, gin being paired with tonic water certainly happens after the invention of tonic water in 1858, and between the first reference to tonic, to a gin and tonic as a cocktail in a party kind of context in 1868. So we've got a 10-year gap. And we also know that that was in India. So between those 10 years of 1858 and 1868, we know that gin and tonic water gets paired together and becomes a popular cocktail. And it's pretty similar to how we'd have a gin and tonic today, with ice and citrus probably, because another popular way of taking gin was gin slings, which is soda, water, lime, sugar, and gin. And we think tonic water probably possibly came as part of that. But yeah, tonic water at the time, we doesn't have had slightly higher properties of quinine in the water, but not enough to be anti-malarial. Nowadays, tonic water has about 83 parts per million in a bottle of tonic water, which is the American standard, and most people stick to that, which isn't enough for malaria, but it's definitely bitter flavored, so it's probably good for the pre-dinner digestive.
Yeah, and I know that at some point in American history, we also had the use of quinine tablets for the treatment of night leg cramps in the elderly, and it's been taken off the market, I believe, because of potential for side effects with chronic usage. Can you tell us a bit about what happens if you consume too much quinine?
Yeah, I mean, people are always really interested in the toxicity question. It's a tricky one because there's a very small number of people who are actually allergic to quinine, but quite a significant number who are sensitive to quinine. So it's always hard to you know, give a general statement on safety. But it's been known for a long time that quinine, is like many natural medicines, it's a poison in origin. That's why it's there in the plant, to deter and poison predators that want to eat the tree. And quinine's no exception. And Rudyard Kipling, the writer of the Jungle Book, has a fantastic essay that we quote from in the book, where he's describing not the effects of the malarial fever that he had in India, but the effects of the quinine that he took to treat it. And one of the reasons why quinine was replaced by synthetic drugs as an anti-malarial in the 1940s was that its toxicity was recognized as if you're taking a high enough dose to be effective, it's quite poisonous. So the effects, Kim, you've got arrhythmia of the heart.
Yeah, you get things like nausea and vomit. I mean, on a spectrum of lesser to more severe symptoms, you can get things like nausea and vomiting, dizziness, visual disturbances, including if it's very extreme to blindness, muscle control problems, and heart arrhythmias. They are reversible if you stop, you know, if you haven't taken too much over a long period of time. But yeah, it's called cinchonism, which is named, you know, is named after the cinchona plant. So
that also has side effects of ringing of the ears, correct?
Yes, actually.
Tinnitus.
Yes, I always forget that one. But that one's a particular one that some people do notice. If they do have drunk quite a lot of gin and tonic, they'll get that ringing in the ears first.
And there's an extensive medical literature on cinchona poisoning because it's super hard to diagnose. The doctor's always very pleased when they do manage to track it down, because people turn up this package of symptoms that could represent a brain tumor. It could represent anything. And you exclude all the possibilities. Then you have to do a lifestyle questionnaire, at which point you pick up what people are drinking, you know, two large bottles of tonic water a day or whatever it might be. It makes a nice little paper when you do that. And there's a lot of them out in the literature.
Yeah, fascinating. So we have some known toxic side effects, but let's talk a bit more about the medicinal properties of tonic and of quinine in particular. How did this protect against malaria, and why do we not use it today? I know that we use other anti-malarials today. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure thing. So now we understand that researchers think that the how quinine works is through, so malaria is caused by a parasite that inhabits the red blood cells and kind of, you know, munches on your blood cells. And part of your blood cell includes iron. And as it munches on your blood cell, it kind of packages up this iron, which would be toxic to itself, and passes it away. But quinine seems to interrupt this cycle and allows the and prevents the parasite from doing this. So it effectively poisons itself as it eats your blood cell because it can't protect itself from these toxic parts. So that's how it works. Quinine and cinchona were the main source of an anti-malarial until about the Second World War. And what happened in the Second World War was the Japanese invaded Indonesia, which was where most of the world's supply of bark was coming from. After this happened, it was really hard to get quinine. And so it was, there was a lot of research went on in the US, and somebody invented a synthetic anti-malarial to replace it. It wasn't a synthetic quinine, but it was a synthetic malarial. And that then took over from quinine after that point.
Oh, interesting.
Do you want to talk about artemisinin?
And it's worth mentioning, well, firstly, that quinine is still used to treat malaria, now, particularly for drug-resistant malaria, when its toxicity is outweighed by the lethal effects of malaria itself. So it's still in the pharmacy of every large hospital will have quinine. But it's also just worth mentioning that the plants are still right at the forefront of the battle against malaria. And since the 1990s, artemisinin from Artemisia annua,
Chinese sweet wormwood.
Has been the leading anti-malarial drug that's used in the developing world.
Mm-hmm. And it was discovered from a 2,000-year-old Chinese pharmacopoeia.
Yeah,
this is a really interesting story.
I love that story. It's and she, the discoverer of this actually won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for this back in 2015.
It was Chu Yu Yu, who's a lady as well, which is great. Yay for winning the Nobel Prize! Yeah, back in 2015.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting about the 2,000-year-old bet was that the secret to getting the greater yield of the active compound was by extracting it in room temperature water instead of with heat or with organic solvents, which are more commonly used in the laboratory. So, yeah, that was fascinating.
I was going to say I like that because it was about, you know, this lady going back after they had failed to get a malarial from this herbal and then actually reading what people were saying at the time, like this is how you have to use it, which I think is a really nice point about traditional knowledge is a very valuable resource.
Well, and this leads into my next question or area that we could talk about a bit more is what was the role of traditional knowledge when it came to cinchona bark and how important was traditional knowledge to this plant making its way into the world stage?
I think it's a really good question because the fact but a lot of the documentation, a lot of the specimens, and in the end, a lot of the production were outside the Americas, in Europe and in Asia, has sometimes, I think, distracted our attention from the really crucial role of source communities or indigenous peoples. And perhaps two interesting areas to think about. And one is how were the properties of quinine, cinchona bark, discovered in Latin America? Because, of course, before the arrival of the Spanish, malaria was pretty much absent, certainly in any severe form, from Latin America, when the Spanish brought enslaved peoples from West Africa with malaria in their blood. The complication is that malaria was most prevalent in Latin America until the 19th century in coastal low-lying areas, but the cinchona trees grow high, they grow 1,500 meters upwards in general areas that until more recent arrival of railways and people were more or less free of malaria. So you've got the remedy in one place and the disease in another place. Now, the first reports of cinchona as an effective anti-malarial date to somewhere between 1600 and 1630. The answer is still buried somewhere in the Spanish archives and is reported by Jesuit priests. But I think we'd be pretty sure it was not Jesuit priests who were tasting, looking for for bitter barks and testing them against fevers. That was surely indigenous healers, of whom, of course, there are many in Latin America. And then later on, when you get this large-scale harvesting of cinchona bark, now, who were the people who knew where the highest yielding forms of bark were? Who were the people who guided the European explorers that came in the 18th and 19th century to look at cinchona trees? Those were the indigenous harvesters. And that's definitely a role that historians and botanists have overlooked in the past.
Yeah. Well, and this also came at great cost to them. I think you cited an example of someone that helped to an indigenous person that worked with one of the explorers to find high yield producing varieties, and he met with an untimely end.
He did. That's the story of Manuel Inca Mamani, who was working with one of the explorers who is credited with bringing back seeds, called Charles Ledger. And sadly, what happened to Manuel was he'd been working with Charles for many years, working on transporting alpaca around South America. And when Ledger read in the newspaper that the British were looking for cinchona seeds, he remembered that he'd been speaking to Manuel one day and pointed out some cinchona and said, "Oh, look, cinchona, do you think those are good ones?" And he said, "No, they're not, because they don't see the white snow-capped mountains." And he realised that Manuel had this, you know, this treasure trove of just being able to look at stands of trees and tell whether they were, like, medicinally valuable or not. And so he asked him to help get some seeds, which he did after a few years of failure. Unfortunately, frost kept killing the trees. And these seeds were credited with starting the Dutch plantations over in Indonesia. But sadly, when people heard that Manuel had sold this, he was arrested and beaten, and he died of his injuries later on.
Yeah, that's really tragic, but not so uncommon during this era of plant exploration and plant theft in some ways, when you have plants that are being removed from communities where they don't want them removed from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
So what was the most surprising thing that you both came across in this research, or was there anything that really stuck out to you as like wow, you hadn't thought of that before as you dug into these archives?
One of my favorite points about the history of cinchona and quinine is actually finding out how important this tree was. Researchers have argued that probably malaria has killed more people in history than any other cause, which is really surprising, especially to people in the West who don't really suffer from malaria so much now. Because as Mark said before, it kind of died out by the First World War. So it's just out of recent living memory. But how malaria affected so many people all the way around the world, even to the up to the Arctic Circle. So that's really surprising. But if it's killed more people than any other cause, then you could argue that cinchona and quinine have possibly saved more lives than any other medicine. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about.
And I think my response would be looking more at the history of tonic water. Actually, my surprise was how little we knew. Now, for this book, we really mined the digital resources of them, completely transformed the work of the historian, and particularly newspaper archives. It's quite hard to find out about the social history of drink. It's not something that official sources record at the time, and newspaper columns were an absolute godsend. And I think we seem to have quite good agreement with a couple of other sources that 1868 is so far the first appearance of a gin and tonic in India, but we're still in question as to when the gin and tonic arrived in Britain. We first kind of pick it up in the newspapers in the 1920s, when there's a whole series of court cases involving drivers who've drunk too many gin and tonics and had accidents or being caught. But I'm slightly worried that they were actually picking up the arrival of drink driving laws rather than the arrival of a gin and tonic. But it's not present in the earlier sources. And people have tied in the arrival of gin and tonic from India to Britain to lots of different things. For example, the end of empire, Indian independence in 1947, which is clearly far too late. And yet, nonetheless, it did take a while to travel. And then there's the whole story about how the gin and tonic arrived in North America post-war, really of the gin following on the tails of Schweppes tonic water and its huge publicity campaigns.
One of my favourite points that Mark's just talking about is in the 1880s, we definitely know that the gin and tonic wasn't around in Britain, because you find a really interesting letter written by a very grumpy person who's saying, "I've just returned from India, the country of the gin and tonic. And in Britain, you can find loads of gin, but can somebody please write to me and tell me where I can find tonic water?" So from this, we know that the gin and tonic was definitely in India and definitely not in Britain by the 1880s, and that neither was tonic water, that though it was invented in Britain, somehow it became more popular in the in the colonies, but didn't come back.
And of course, it changed as the Schweppes introduced Indian tonic water. Mm-hmm. So as so often with plants, and Cassie, you'll know that there's such a common phenomenon, you get this travel and return. So tonic water is invented in Britain, travels to the tropics, is reinvented and paired with alcohol in an entirely new way, then comes back to Britain. So you know, every time you have a glass of tonic water or even a gin and tonic, you've got a whole global story in that glass. And that's what we tried to tell in the book.
Yeah, and then you factor in the citrus and you have a whole other area of Asia as well. It's
and of course, the reminder that why is the citric acid or the slice of lemon there? Because it helps the quinine dissolve, as does the alcohol.
Oh, fascinating.
Well, the role of acid is quite important. The original ingredient, the original ingredients for
first tonic water,
was it phosphoric?
No, sulfuric acid.
Sulfuric acid. Citric acid is a great improvement.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about these the drink recipes. This is, you know, the special treat that awaits at the end of the book. You have all these fabulous recipes of different. Different tonic creations. And there was one, I think it was the if I'm recalling correctly, the perfect gin and tonic, which I do believe I tried to make myself at home and it was quite perfect.
Quite strong as well. Yeah, I would say this is possibly one of the most fun parts of the book, even though it was all fun. Q, which has its own gin and tonic, very kindly donated it for this very specific research project, which was most enjoyable. But we thought about doing 10 recipes, all based around historic points in the history of gin and the history of cinchona and gin and tonic. So you get ones based on very old English recipes for using the cinchona bark for your malaria medicine. And then also we pick up on the story where when tonic water first comes over to India, and it's not just paired with gin. This is also tied in with a story that some people say that quinine was put into gin in a way to take your medicine. And we found from the resources that this wasn't always true. In fact, gin rarely makes an appearance. It often appears with rum and brandy and wine. So in the book, you'll find not just gin and tonic recipes, but you'll have rum tonic, brandy tonic, whiskey tonic, and lots of mocktails as well for people that prefer not to have any alcohol.
That's great.
And it's worth adding, actually, that, I mean, tonic water is often, being drunk, it's still drunk straight or on the continent of Europe. It's their favourite soft drink. And it's coming back into favour here as a straight drink because, you know, there's a tendency away from alcohol, particularly amongst young people. But at the same time, if you're trying to avoid really sugary drinks, when a tonic water is an adult, slightly bitter, slightly astringent, very refreshing drink. And when you're drinking a tonic water, no one, of course, can tell whether you're drinking a tonic or a gin and tonic.
It's true. Also, I think as well, another interesting thing was that the temperance movement really liked tonic waters as well. So as you're drinking it, you can think about how it was also appreciated without the gin in the history.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, and I know just from recent travels that you can now get many different variations on flavor in your tonic water, from kind of Mediterranean flares to citrusy, and there are all these new options that have come out. But of course, you always have that lovely bitter underlying quality. One of my favorite tricks I like to show my medical botany classes, I bring a UV light to class with some tonic. And so have you ever tried the bar trick of seeing the fluorescent quinine?
Yeah, we have it. So it's a good one. You can tell if you're in a club where they've got UV lighting who's drinking gin and tonic, because they've got glow-in-the-dark glasses.
Yeah.
And we have brought it out at science festivals, and kids really love that trick, is to show, ask them which one has got tonic water on, which glass of water or tonic water is the one that's glowing in the dark. And it's worth having a look at if you can get a little UV torch, which are very cheap, to shine on your cocktail.
It's fun. So what's next with this research? So you've launched this beautiful book, and I know that there's still more to be studied when it comes to the chemistry and the botany of cinchona. Can you tell us a bit more about future plans in this area?
Yeah, so I'm just going into third year now, so hopefully the project is now to write up my thesis rather than books. But what we're doing is looking at this big project at Kew on these collections and see how they were used during the 19th century by scientists who were trying to unpick this story of the species and the chemistry content of different species, and how these tools, these barks and these herbarium, were used in this way, and how this informed how quinine and cinchona ended up getting used in transferred over to plantations. And also, we're collaborating with scientists in Copenhagen. Mark, do you want to talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, this is a collaboration of Nina Ronstedt's lab and with Nathalie Canali's kind of parallel PhD student to Kim's. So Kim is using the archival and historical sources and the specimens here, and Nathalie is looking at the chemistry and the DNA of those historic specimens from Kew. And actually, the first paper from that work went to press today in Journal of Ethnopharmacology. It's now online.
Fantastic. I'll have to take a look. Yeah.
And that's a really nice integration of the most modern technology. And it's been really hard work for Nathalie to get the DNA out of the bark specimens, because there's so many other chemicals and alkaloids in there. They interfere with the DNA extraction process. But I think that sometimes there's a weakness in the analytical studies using historical material, but the background of historical material is not well known. In this case, we've got a fantastic PhD student here, Kim, working on the history, so we can really integrate the biology and the human story.
Fantastic. Well, I want to applaud you both on a lovely book. As I said, it's richly written, and also I just loved all of the different images that you were able to pull, and the quotes from newspapers and from literature of the period that talks about this. It really puts it into an interesting context when you think about the whole picture of what goes into tonic water. And so for the audience, for the listeners, you can find the book. It's called Just the Tonic. It's written by Kim Walker and Mark Nesbitt, and it's published by the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. Thank you both so much for coming on the show. And I can't wait to come back to Kew and rummage around a bit more in your economic botany collection, because it is a vast treasure trove of cool botany to explore.
Well, thank you very much, Cassie.
Yes, thank you, Cassie. Pleasure to speak to you.
Wow, what a fascinating story. Who would have known that so much history goes into your simple glass of gin and tonic? Well, if you like this discussion and would like to learn more, you can definitely get the book, Just the Tonic, now available for purchase. It's already out in the UK, and the US version of the book will release on December 4th. Of note, profits from the book go to support new research and conservation work at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew. Check out the Foodie Pharmacology website for this episode for more links and information. Next time on Foodie Pharmacology, we're going to travel into the magical forest that inspired Tolkien's creation of Middle-earth. While there, I met up with a mushroom forager, Daniel Butler, who takes people out on tours around Wales to learn how to collect wild edible mushrooms. So we're going to get into a really fun discussion around how to go about foraging, both safely and with a conservation mindset. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. I've got an awesome lineup of future shows, so be sure to subscribe. And check out old episodes, all available on SoundCloud and iTunes, or you can also browse through them on our website at ethnobotanica.us/podcast. You can also find me on our Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page or Twitter or Instagram at my Quave Ethnobot account, spelled Quave Ethnobot. I'll see you next time.